KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest has done pretty well for himself in the 25 years since I last spoke to him on this show. Of course, he's won an Emmy for Mr. Show with Bob and David, and has been nominated 4 times for a little show called Better Call Saul, which has had an astonishing mid-season finale, and is now the author of a book, Comedy, 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 Drama. I'm speaking to Bob Odenkirk. Bob, it's always good to talk to you.
Good talking to you, Elvis.
One of the things I've always been struck by, and we get to see it in Saul, but it's kind of something that kind of runs through the book, is that it's always amused me when you play characters who wear suits, because they always are acting what they think their version of an adult is.
That's funny. As an actor, you get a lot from your costume and your makeup. I learned that a long time ago when I was doing comedy at Who's On First in Elmhurst, a little comedy club. And we had a Sunday night show that I talk about a bit in my book, because there were such interesting people there doing oddball stuff. We had Sunday nights, and Leo Benvenuti, who is an inspiration to many of us and later became a writer and of The Santa Claus, as well as Space Jam. He used to have these pieces of carpeting that he would use as facial hair. He had cut them up into sideburns, mustaches, and beards. And they had like duct tape they would stick them on with. And I could watch him work in a mirror with these heavy pieces of black carpeting that he turned into characters. I guess it's some form of mask work if you're a theater nerd. Or, My Dinner with Andre and that kind of intense theatrical elemental work. But he was doing it in a comedy club. And I saw him put stuff on his face and then look in the mirror and then like kind of do a voice and change his posture. And I learned really to look at myself in the costume and think about who that person is wearing those clothes. And it's funny you say it's a kid dressing up or a kid pretending to be an adult, and that's what a suit does for you. It makes you present yourself as an adult, even if you're not.
No, but I was thinking about that even going back to the intros for Mr. Show, where you would always come out in a suit. And I thought, well,
that's true. And David Cross would wear shorts and a T-shirt, and he wanted it to be as real as he could make it, which is to say you just wear your street clothes. And I always felt like that was as much of a fraud as any costume you could wear, because the truth is, you know, you're going to be on camera. You know, the traditional form of dress is to dress up somewhat and be presentable. So any choice you make in front of the camera is intentional and is kind of a front of some kind. So I just chose to dress up in Mr. Show because I felt like, I don't know, I felt like the audience, I owed it to them to say, we worked on this thing. We prepared this thing for you. It's intentional and we want it to be good. We mean to be professionals here and we're not just sloppy kids goofing around. But anyway, maybe we were that. I don't know.
Even thinking about that, seeing you in the paper, I think, wow, this is a guy who's presenting. And that's been so often something I thought about, just going back again to Mr. Show for me. And of course, I sort of set this in sort of like visual terms, the contrast between you and David on the show, even though this thing you both had in common is something you get at the book even, is you both have this contempt for institutional authority.
Very much so. Contempt for authority. It's a thread that runs through my book and through my life. And yet we need to sometimes become the people in charge. It's a tough thing to ride the line between contempt for authority and being the authority or being, you know, important to other people. and trying to run an organization of any kind, you have to have some structures and you have to support them a bit. I mean, if you looked at me and David, that was such a great presentation for Mr. Show. Ultimately, it was great that he wore shorts and a t-shirt and I wore a suit. It said, we're here to do a show and this is us. You know, that was him. This is us. We're just a bunch of people goofing around, making each other laugh. So it was a mix of the two, and that was perfect.
One of the things I really love about the book is that it really is a book about a book of enthusiasms. And when you're talking about people who really matter to you, who you really connect with, who you admire, be it Chris Farley or Janine Garofalo or even Sean McBride, whose performance in Let's Go to Prison, by the way, is astonishing. I mean, he is so real in that.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I wrote a book, is to tell people about people who I revere and whose work and or presence, personal presence, I love so much. And I love that you pointed out Shy McBride, because Shy literally came in and auditioned for that movie. And it made me realize how poorly I'd handled every audition I'd ever done up till I saw him. And then after that, I did what he did. I copied him, which was total professional, crazy prepared, killed it, could have shot it as he did it in the audition. What's the point of going into an audition and showing your stuff if you're not killing it? There's just no point in going in there and showing, yeah, I guess I could do this part at some point. You know, show them the part as you see it.
Again, to me, the book is about just falling in love constantly. It's the through line for that really goes through the book, that you're constantly able to find these new enthusiasms.
You're making me think about an idea I had yesterday, and I told my wife about it. It's like a new show idea. And like, I really, really am at a point in my career where I, and my life, really, not my career, my life, where I want to slow down. You know, the heart attack last year, everyone asked me how it affected me, and I didn't have a white light moment. I didn't go towards the light and know that I was dead and then come back. No one talked to me. I literally blanked out, came back, and felt like no time had passed, and was looking around the hospital room going, let's go back to work. What's going on? What are you guys doing here? So I was deprived of that existential benediction of some, you know, otherworldly presence and some kind of sense of life. So what it's done though, Elvis, is it's resonated through the months since. It's almost a year since then. And I've thought about it an awful lot. I've heard people tell me about what it was like when they were there. And the thing I've been thinking is I can't keep just chasing the latest enthusiasm. It's worked well for me, as you see from the book. But I think I got to find another way forward. I think it's been a great, I still pitch it to everyone as a way to handle a showbiz career. But then when you turn 60, which I will later this year, I think then you got to ask yourself, maybe what's the next chapter and how could that be handled differently? That's what I'm going through right now. Maybe I'll be able to change a bit in a good way, but maybe not. I don't know. This idea I had yesterday made me laugh so hard. I know there's a show in it.
Can you say what it is?
Well, I kind of can. You know, there's an article in the New Yorker about some place called Margaritaville. It's like a retirement home for seniors. It's not a retirement home. It's like it's a community of people who are older, who like Jimmy Buffett music or the vibe of it. And so I'm thinking of an animated show that is more David Lee Roth. And also old people, though, because that, whether I like it or not, that will soon be my life and my milieu.
My guest, who I think still is probably capable of enthusiasms, whether he wants to admit it or not, is our old friend Bob Odenkirk. His book is Comedy, 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 Drama. And in reading the book and knowing you a little bit, I just sort of thought, what a great way to lead your life. I mean, because you at one point you talked in the book about somebody asking you for advice. And I just thought, well, if your divining rod is just finding yourself with people who you want to be in business with or create with, more specifically, because you're always going to at some point find some satisfaction from the pleasure of just working with these people, if nothing else.
Yes. Yeah, Elvis, you're right. I mean, the bottom line is, I think it was a business that you could trajectorize and plot and plan a career many, many years ago when the business was structured differently. I just don't think you can do that in the last, like, it's just not going to happen anymore. So how do you move forward and how do you make a good life? You know, you can't guarantee success with any project. So it's just got to be a rewarding thing on some basic level to do the work. And one way to assure that is you're doing ideas that really make you happy and aren't just built for the audience, to try to appease an audience or chase an audience. And the other way is to work with people that you really like, because it's a social business. It really is. I mean, we're not writing novels and stuff here. We're working together to build these things. It's almost always a collaborative thing, almost right from the beginning.
Well, I guess I thought about that too, because there's so many incidents in the book you talk about. Well, I was just thinking about how when you were shooting Hoops with Conan O'Brien and what was going to replace Late Night with David Letterman, and he just sort of offhandedly says, would you want to do this? And you just,
yeah.
Well, no.
Yeah, it was a weird moment. Now, obviously, Conan couldn't have offered it to me. He didn't have the power to, and he didn't have the role yet. And I didn't have the credits probably to get it, although he had fewer credits than mine and he got it. But he wanted it so badly. But it was a moment to ask yourself, I don't know, you know, you're on TV every night, you tell jokes, that's fun. You do some comedy bits, that's fun. And yeah, I got bumped up when I thought, yeah, but you got to talk to a bunch of celebrities. Some you like, some you don't know their stuff at all or care at all. And I think I'm not a fan enough of a broad enough range of, you know, music and television to have wanted to do that job.
Well, for me, though, that moment is about you realizing, without saying it to yourself, that you're not a dilettante, that it goes back to what we're talking about. There's got to be something that you can invest yourself in immediately. And so many of these things in your weather vane about that is really something. As soon as it starts to sort of click in that direction, and these are people that you want to be around, and it's something that you can see yourself pursuing, it seems like almost subtextually in a book that when these things happen to you, you can say to yourself, yeah, I can see myself doing this. And that's where you tend to go.
The thing I've learned over time is to take a little more time to feel whether that drive, that initial spark, is something that will maintain and that you're willing to dig into. Because projects are hard. I mean, it takes months and even years to make things happen. And so it's got to be something you could see yourself caring about for years. And that's the only difference between, you know, just pursuing the next thing that you like. To take more time to decide what that might be because of a career in show business, just feeling how long it can take to make a project happen.
You're talking about these kind of lightning-like moments, and you actually had one. You mentioned in the book that time running with Del Close that just sort of pulled you down this river or where you wanted to be.
I was definitely wishing and wanting to pursue writing and sketch performance when I met Del Close, but I was also unsure. I mean, I still felt very distant from anything professional, as people do almost anywhere. I mean, like a lot of people who come from the Midwest, I talk about my Midwest roots and how showbiz was such a distant, impossible thing. Well, you know, the truth is people in the Valley feel that way too. They also feel like it's a million miles away, even though it's right over the hill. But, framing the book with that conversation with Del was an easy, inspired moment of choice, because everything he promised in his rant and ramble about showbiz was true and was the value that I loved about showbiz. Lots of people, lots of interesting, funny, strange experiences, and a kind of a excitement for your mind that I don't think I saw in any other career. Here was a guy, I was talking to Del, he was 49, but I would have said he was 60. I mean, he had done a lot of cocaine and heroin and smoked a lot, and he did not look good. But he had this incredible energy. He was, his mind was on fire for this theater project he was going to do a week from our meeting. And I just thought, boy, I want that when I'm 60. I want that feeling. If I can feel that way about life, that's worth it.
We'll take a break. My guest was talking about geographical and spiritual topography is Bob Odenkirk. His terrific book is Comedy, 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 Drama. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is our old friend Bob Odenkirk, who's been away way too long, but he's been doing okay for himself. We know him now, of course, as the star of Better Call Saul, and his book is Comedy, 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 Drama. And you were talking before the break, and that encounter to me set the tone of the book, because it's really about you sort of being turned on by these turns of mind of people. Maybe Jill Talley or Conan or any number of people who you can just sort of see you kind of immediately just fall in love with the way their minds work and want to be around them.
Yeah. Here I just talked to you early in our interview about how I'm trying to sort of perceive a different way forward for myself as I enter my 60s. And yet today I'm going to have lunch with a young screenwriter, somebody I've met with 3 or 4 times over the last 2 years. I'm just encouraging her. I can see that her desire is genuine. Her work ethic is amazing. She's doing, you know, odd jobs to pay the rent, but churning out screenplays. And I can't help myself. I just get excited by those creative minds, those people with talent and a certain kind of inspired energy that they live and that I always want to help them. I write a little about Tim and Eric in the book, and you know, and they're just an example of a couple people who I helped, but who made it. I mean, there's a lot of people who didn't make it or didn't make it exactly maybe where I could talk about them and you'd know them. And many of those people are still on their road, you know, still finding their place in this business. But I love doing that. I love seeing somebody with talent and seeing if I can give them a shortcut to an opportunity.
So much that was sort of encapsulated in Mr. Show. You wrote about your reaction to being a part of that versus SNL, where it didn't really happen. But you want to be on the right team. And I was just thinking about that, your observations about Lorne Michaels versus Gary Shandling. And just when it's, you know, when you feel like all the components can be there is when you can really invest.
I think actually as a younger person, I was, I don't know if that hypercritical aspect of my character, which you see in a lot of young people, it's weird because I think I share how uncertain I was and how I was finding myself and I didn't feel confident. And yet here I was critiquing everybody around me and all the shows around me. How much of that is just genuine, youthful, high ideals that are good and a good thing? And how much of it is really just a protective mechanism to separate yourself out from everything because you don't really think you're worthy of being there at all? It's a mix of the two, but it leads to some great things. I will say that the show I imagined when I was at Saturday Night Live, a show where you could rewrite the sketches and build them out and try to make them stronger, a show where you could rehearse your performances and perform them, act them instead of reading cue cards, a show where instead of just talking about the topical issue of the week, you could maybe dig a little deeper and sort of reveal something beneath the surface of that issue. Here I was thinking about that at SNL and wishing that show could lean in that direction. And then, you know, 6 years later, I was making that show. And I do think it was good. So that youthful aspiration that I used to judge everything around me turned out to be true.
You tend to be more attracted to things that are inventing themselves in real time rather than something. And this gets back to your sort of jaundiced eye towards institutions. And by the time you got to Saturday Night Live, it was that. It was an institution.
Here's the thing, Elvis. I didn't know that SNL was an institution or that I was trying to be one. look, think about when I went there. The first 5 years were astounding, a phenomenon, cultural phenomenon. Then the next 5 years were hit and miss, but with, you know, Eddie Murphy killing it and a few great moments. And then here comes Lorne. And I think in his mind, he was aiming to make it an institution, the show bigger than the cast members, bigger than anybody who happens to come through or any group who happens to come through. I think he was right to want that and to turn it into that. I just didn't know that's what he was doing. I thought he was trying to recreate the first 5 years by getting a small group of intense people together and then letting them really put their brains on display and create something more niche and more pure and intense. But he was not trying to do that because he didn't, I'm sure he thought, well, I don't know what he thought. I'd love to know what he thought. I wish he would write a book or somebody would write one with him because I would love to know what he thought. I do think, though, he was wanting that show to be bigger than the cast and the writers so that it wouldn't end every 5 years, so that every 5 years there wouldn't be like this, uh-oh, everybody left to go do movies and TV, and now we got nothing.
It's the treatment. My guest who's being quite philosophical is Bob Odenkirk. His terrific book is Comedy, 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 Drama. My feeling is you're being attracted to things that are new and finding themselves.
Yeah.
That period in the early 2000s was when you were directing a lot. I wonder if that was part of the appeal of all that to you as well, that you got to find a project and nurture it and build it out and turn it into something and let it find itself.
Yeah, I think directing is that job. You are the storyteller as a director. You're pulling all the strings on some level. You're the final arbiter of things. And, you know, I did feel that the things I was trying to do, except for the Brothers Solomon, which I never figured out, I'd say Let's Go to Prison. I had an idea in my head that I thought was pretty neat, like make it feel like a 70s B movie and have fun with the cameras and make it feel gritty and kind of a little bit dirtier and tougher than a comedy of the time when it came out. And I think we did that. I think we could have used some work on the script. But those are exciting things. Directing movies are, to me, the most rewarding job you can do. I just don't think I'm actually equipped for it because there are other qualities that you need to have that I don't think I have. I would like to direct a movie again, but I'm not trying hard to do that. Maybe there'll be something that comes along that I say, I'm the person for this. That's what you want. You want to feel like you are qualitatively the person for this particular story that you're telling.
Well, we can't have this conversation, Bob, without ending up, of course, with Better Call Saul in the most recent episode with what happens to Patrick Fabian. That's the point where what Jimmy McGill was sort of playing at, we get to see when he invests himself in something and works towards something, even if it's a bad end, that he can do what he wants to do. And that, to me, is the real terror in that.
Yeah, it seems to be true in numerous subplots through the years on that show. I mean, I think that there's a couple things you could point to as the main themes of the show, but I think that this guy's inability to find a place for his skills in the world, a place that is rewarding to both him and society, or you could say a place that's both rewarding to him and the people he loves, he can't seem to find a place to be this manipulator of logic, of other people, of their allegiances, of their truths and lies, and use that talent, if you want to call it that, propensity, and use it in some way that then gets him the love of the people he loves. They sort of don't respect him for what he's good at, and it's torture for him. That, to me, is really what's happening. Now, Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, who created the show, said it's really a story of a person who's wanting love. So I think that we're in line on that. and he's trying to use his skills to get it. This is what I'm good at. Watch me go. And he gets it briefly with Kim. There's a kind of a high, a kind of a thrill as they do these con jobs. But it's, again, it's no lasting reward. And he still knows she doesn't fully respect him. And then, of course, he tried to get respect from his older brother, Chuck, played by Michael McKean. And he could never get that, ever. That was never coming his way.
You know what's so amazing about the show? And this almost takes us back to where we started, this idea of sort of like becoming an adult once you put on the suit. And he does that. But, you know, it's almost as if anybody who listens to Jimmy, he has no respect for.
Yeah, if you trust me, I don't respect you. It's not a good way to look at life. So one of the hardest things for me in playing the character is that, you know, these are his mental mechanisms. If you trust me, I don't respect you. I'll take more advantage of you. If you won't give me some love and some respect for what I do, I will try to hurt you in the way that I feel hurt. There's that great Randy Newman song, I Just Want You to Hurt Like I Do. I love that song. And I thought about it so much when I played Jimmy. I thought about that song so often, so many days. That was running through my head because I thought that's what that character was, not subconscious, like almost consciously thinking. Why am I doing this? Because I want you, whoever it is, I want you to hurt like I do because of maybe what you did or didn't give me. And it's a terrible way. It's not going to build you. You might have a moment of satisfaction or feeling of achievement. I don't know. But it's not really a way to build a life.
When he sees somebody paying attention to him, the light goes out of his eyes.
Yeah. He's tortured. Now, I just want to say that where the show goes in the last six episodes that are to come, I can't wait for people to see, especially if people are listening to this and thinking about what you and I just talked about. Because the argument I had with Vincent Peter was, can people learn the right lessons from their trauma and pain? I think sometimes my argument is sometimes they can. Not often, probably not most of the time, but occasionally people take all the pain in their lives and the experiences and think a little harder and go somewhere that's better because they genuinely see themselves. And so I can't, without giving away anything about where he goes, and it's certainly not a, it's not like a life that anybody would envy, seen from the outside, but seen from the inside, I think he goes somewhere that I feel great about.
Wow. Well, given where Saul ended up in Breaking Bad, that's a really tantalizing teaser. Bob, I hope you come back and talk about it. So, because it's always great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Elvis. Always.
That was our old friend Bob Odenkirk, star of AMC's Better Call Saul and author of the memoir Comedy, 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 Drama. For those of you who can stay for the next segment, you'll hear Bomani Jones, host of HBO's Game Theory with Bomani Jones. If not, that interview and past episodes of The Treatment can be heard at kcrw.com/The Treatment. And The Treatment can be heard wherever you get your podcasts. Stay tuned and keep listening to The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest has had a storied career writing about music, on sports, doing ESPN, and has gone from writing about players being forced to wear suits in the NBA to now wearing $5,500 suits on HBO on his show, Game Theory with Bomani Jones. Hey, thank you so much for doing this.
No problem, man.
Listen, the one thing I've always loved about the way you work is that you understand that sports is a conduit for culture and for politics, and you treat it as a larger mosaic rather than just this discrete discipline.
There's two levels to that, right? And I think that if I got a superpower in this, if anybody were to have such a thing, is that I do recognize what is important about sports, but it's also key to understand what's not important about sports. And where I think it becomes like a crucial thing for me and the way that I go about this is I'm going to take the serious thing seriously, but I don't necessarily know if my average colleague understands that those are the serious things. The things that aren't serious, I'm probably going to laugh at, but that is often me laughing at things that people take really seriously.
But the thing about it is there's always that one thing that somebody takes seriously, and you kind of made a career sort of pointing this out, that seems so surreal as to be absurd.
So I tell this story all the time about when Riley Cooper, who played wide receiver for the Eagles, was caught at a Kenny Chesney concert saying that he wanted to fight every N-word there. OK, and so it was a wonderful piece of happenstance that when this happened, it was the weekend of the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. So all the on-call people for these matters were busy. It just so happened I hadn't gotten there yet. I was on the road from Miami to Orlando to get there. And so they called me and, you know, so they talking to me in all the dour tones, you know, and everything else about it. And they're like, Bomani, what do you think? And all I had was jokes, right? I was just like, oh, he's going to fight every, oh, but he's going to fight all three of them? All three of them at the Kenny Chesney concert? That's who he's going to fight? Like, that's not really a bold declaration that he's made. And they weren't ready for that, right? All they had were, they were ready for me to burn the world down to be just like righteously indignant. And I was just kind of like, yo, this is hilarious.
Then the reason I say you look at sports as being really kind of the center of target for culture, because everything touches on it. The economy, politics, religion. It's at some point, it all kind of funnels through this conduit of sports, doesn't it?
Sports is kind of like the best sandwich shop in your city. Say you got a sandwich shop that's in a downtown of a major city or like a state capital city or something like that. You got the sandwich shop that everybody knows has got the sandwiches. Everybody's at that sandwich shop. And what I mean by everybody is, so if you use like the state capitol analogy, it's going to be some judges, it's going to be some state senators, it's also going to be some construction workers, right? It's going to be a couple of bus drivers, because everybody likes sandwiches. And so you got the sandwich spot, everybody finds out about it, you're going to get a very clear slice of life in that sandwich shop while people like wait for their number to get called so they can go pick up their sandwiches. Sports is like that in that same way. The things that are attractive to people about sports and that bring them into it, they aren't specific to any particular race, class, gender, whatever group you want to break down. That's just not really how it works. And so once you get in it, like there's a diversity among the participants, certainly, but there's more importantly a diversity amongst the consumers. And so what that means is any topic that comes up, there's going to be so many different ways that people probably ultimately wind up seeing it because there's so many people doing the seeing.
All these things you've done before, it gives you a chance to do them all in the same place. And that's got to be thrilling to you.
Yeah, well, it's also the chance to do all this stuff with a budget. Well, you know, when you're working as a freelance writer, all you got is your writing. Like, I did YouTube stuff for a while, and, you know, we had some money to make it, but I wouldn't say that we had a budget. Like, the resources that I got to pull some of this stuff off and that we were able to use to do season one, like, that's the game changer. There was a point in my career where I was coming up with stuff like this, but I could, you know, I could put it out with the means that I had to put them out. And then while I'm working at ESPN, I never had a budget. I'm not saying, I don't want to intimate that they are cheap or anything like that, because that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying the things that I did were not the things where they just like, yo, here's a bunch of money, do what you can come up with. So now, you know, we got constraints, obviously, but it's just we got a lot more money to make stuff happen. Like, we got money where I'm not the person who has to come up with every single thing.
Everybody I know who follows you feels the same way, kind of waiting for you to have had this opportunity and wondering if things similar came your way. You just thought this wasn't the right fit for me and I'm not going to do this. So I'll just end up being like the utility player. You know, you can always count on me.
I want to also be fair to ESPN about that. You know, things change as regimes change and as your supervisor changes and different people look at you different ways. Now, one thing that is very, very interesting about a big company, which is it is amazing how if somebody up high likes you, how much more the people below them begin to like you. I was not a utility player at ESPN. Like, they saw me as like a for real starter contributor under the landscape where studio opinion shows did numbers, right? And people really watched them, and that was a big deal. And I was treated and viewed as a person who was important to doing those things. But the landscape kind of changed a little bit, and then the demand for that type of content just wasn't there in the way that it used to be. When High Noon was canceled, they didn't start creating another studio opinion show, right? Like, it was a sign they weren't in that business anymore. When Highly Questionable got canceled, they didn't create a new studio opinion show. They were stepping out of that business. And so then once they step out of that business, it becomes, okay, so what you got? And so there, you could make the argument that it became more of a like utility player sort of situation. But I think a lot of people who have observed my career have felt as though ESPN could have done more with me. And I mean, at times I could probably felt that way. But I really think that ESPN looked at it like, hey, man, this is what we do. And these are the things that he can do that fits what we do.
You make the point that, you know, as they're business axis shifted and their focus shifted, there's certain things they moved away from. But it's always seemed to me that the network is really based as much as anything on personality and this kind of protean personality that sees the world in total rather than, as we're talking about, in discrete ways. And you're that guy.
The bedrock of that network is not personalities and has not been personalities. The bedrock of that network has been sports. That's the foundational thing that brings people in. A whole lot more people watch those games than ever watch the rest of us talk about them, right? Like, the sports part is the foundation. And so when the culture wars got started, I mean, it started, but, you know, they really are ramping up like 2016, 2017. It just so happened that you had these dominant stories in the sports landscape that had like real social ramifications to them. And they began to envelop a lot of like the straight sports stuff that people were talking about. When those things happen, by the way, in the world, ESPN is still like, when George Floyd happens in 2020, ESPN was wall to wall George Floyd, just like everybody else. You know, like, it's not like they just completely got out of that business. But I think that they just got caught in this tug of war, push and pull, honestly, involving a lot of people who I think were operating with dishonest intentions. And so from there, you did see we're going to talk more about sports. That's what we're going to do. We are going to talk more about the games. And they did that. But I think also they did then go to step out when issues came up that were of like legitimate national importance and things that came up. They went and did that. But there is a book called Those Guys Have All the Fun, which is Jim Miller's oral history of the history of ESPN. And I think that it was John Saunders who tells the story. Somebody else, basically, where some executive had gotten very comfortable and told him that like guys like him and Chris Berman were the worst thing to happen to the network because they wanted a situation where the talent will wind up being interchangeable. Like, that's the story that Saunders told. And you did get to a point where the company recognized that that wasn't necessarily going to be it. Now, I think rather than everybody's got to be a personality, they're really just leaning in on some particular personalities rather than the broad assortment that wound up being in all the places that we used to be in before. I mean, this thing is built around Stephen A. Smith, who is, number one, the best in the business at this, and number two, has no shortage of personality.
Stephen A. is an institution there, too. And at a certain point, if we can torture sports metaphor here, baton should be passed. And, you know, somebody else should get a chance to hit the track. And I was betting on you.
Well, I mean, I still work there. Don't forget that. The thing about baton passing in this industry, many, many years ago, ESPN hired Todd McShay. And Todd McShay was a draft analyst and a younger guy than the established Mel Kiper, who basically invented the industry. It's been well over a decade since they hired Todd McShay. And you know who the number one dude is in the game at the draft? Mel Kiper Jr. That's who it is, right? Like that idea, like maybe there will be a day that comes where Stephen A. passes a baton to somebody, but he ain't holding that thing looking for somebody to give it to. He's very helpful. He's been very kind to me. And in my career, he sat for our interview on the first show. I am a big fan of the guy. But yeah, baton passing, nah, not really how it goes. And if I were Stephen A. and I was ESPN and I was at this moment, I wouldn't be thinking about Stephen A. passing a baton. Like, he's that dude right now. You know, the point may come where he's not that dude anymore. But I think it's interesting that, like, when I bring up Stephen A., I hear people talk about things like this would pass the baton. But nobody really says those same things about Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon. And I find that to be interesting because Stephen A. is the generation after those guys. Those guys have been doing that show for 20 years. It's just that people love that show. Like, that show is not a polarizing sort of thing. But that's the one where nobody is ever like, yo, who's the next person? You know, where's the next guy going to come from?
My guest, who I think has been doing this for a minute and has been doing pretty great, Bomani Jones's show on HBO, is Game Theory with Bomani Jones. And I'm guessing apparently he didn't realize that HBO has a show called The Shop, since LeBron James has been a frequent subject on Game Theory.
Yes. Yes. Yes, he has. I mean, how could he not? He's LeBron James.
But he seems like he leads until you turn to him. The life unexamined is the best way to put it.
It's actually interesting because I was thinking about like things we might do for season two. And I'm trying to think about like what there is, you know, what to do with LeBron, because we're going to be 20 years of LeBron next year. How many LeBron phases do we have to his career? Like clear epochs of division of where he is at a different point in time. And so we had like the young LeBron that goes to about 07 when he gets to the NBA finals. And at that point, expectations are now attached. And now you get from that until he leaves Cleveland, where he becomes LeBron James. He becomes not just the best basketball player in the league, but maybe the best basketball player that we have ever seen. It's a legitimate question to ask at that point. You have the Miami period, which starts with him being like the villain in black and then, you know, shows his maturity and he grows all the way up and he does that. There's that return to Cleveland that will always be weird to me because, I mean, you left, you know what I'm saying? You ain't have to do that. But he decided, okay, I'm going to go back to Cleveland. He decided he was going to redeem that part of his reputation. Like, it felt like such a big narrative play, and he pulled it off. He won a championship there. He then goes to the number one franchise in the history of the league that's down, and no matter where they look right now as the Lakers, they won a championship with LeBron James. He instantly returned them to relevance. Like, he has been the center of everything, I would say, truly for 15 years in a way that we have never seen, and it has had some real positives, and now it's just a little bit boring, and it'll be cool when he retires.
Well, but I mean, you get this interesting thing, and this is something you've been doing, it's not just on Game Theory, but for a while, this idea of this guy who almost feels like a baby boomer, that he doesn't know when to get off the stage.
Well, what's interesting now is because people want things to be so binary, because if you want me to gush over LeBron and things he's done, I could give you a full hour, right? If you wanted me to give my criticisms of LeBron, I could give them to you right now. But I think we are currently catching LeBron in a very interesting period in his career where, yeah, I could say maybe LeBron should hang it up. But the league isn't telling him he should hang it up because he's still that good, right? He's not one of the five best players in the NBA anymore. You probably could make an argument he's not one of the 10 best players in the NBA anymore. But he is still a really good NBA basketball player. So it ain't right for me or somebody to tell LeBron, yo, you need to leave, right? Because he's still a player. He still can play and he still matters. But it's not fair to say it's his fault that we have made him the center of things in the ways that we have, where it's hard for there to be room for other people as long as LeBron's on the stage. We contributed to that. He certainly got a lot out of it and seemed to dig it and now wants to hold on to it. But we absolutely gave it to him. But we've never had like a Truman Show type of character like him, who, since he's been 18 years old, has just been dead in our faces this whole time. And how would he ever know how to like move out of the light or get away from the attention when that's all it's ever been?
You say with sports, we should be able to hold more than one idea in our head at one time. And a lot of sports commentary sort of demands the opposite.
The tricky part isn't really holding two thoughts at one time as much as being able to present two thoughts at one time to people in a way where they can still hold on to those two thoughts. I think a lot of people are capable of holding those two thoughts, but how do you get those two thoughts across? That part's not nearly as simple, right? Like that's the communication part more than the horsepower part. And often it's a matter of pointing out, putting people in a position where they recognize that they actually know these things already. They just hadn't quite thought about it like that. But those aren't necessarily skills that everybody's going to have. I got those because I got some travels that have taken me to a lot of places where I needed a lot of different kinds of people to understand what I was saying. And you figure out how to talk to them in those ways. So like with LeBron, for example, the part that I didn't get to that I think is the most interesting and complex is him at the vanguard of this idea of player empowerment. And I don't know how well that's worked out for him or anybody else. But it's here and it's happened, and it's happened because of him. And it reflects, I think, a lot of things about the generation of basketball players. And also, I just think a lot about a larger society and the faith it does and does not have in institutions. All of those things come together like in these 20 years of LeBron James. Like you could even think about it in another way. LeBron hits the league in 2003. Facebook hits the streets in 2004, I believe. LeBron is the most visible person who has been consistently something and native to the social media landscape, which then adds another level to like what he is and how he interacts with us all.
And you're right. But I think what I'm getting at by talking about holding two thoughts in your head is that it's something that sports commentary as a medium tends to discourage. It's about basically kind of building advocacy and fomenting argument. There's a historical perspective that you take on all this. There's a kind of rigor that comes from the educational background you have, which says, well, you can have two things that are diametrically opposed, but that won't preclude your enjoyment of them as a phenomenon.
I don't know how much sports coverage discourages it as much as people don't know how to do that. For example, no one has ever encouraged or discouraged me from talking about these things in any way. Most of these people who do this show up doing that in the first place because that's what they know how to do. And the simplest way to get things done or like to make sure that you have something that works, and I think this is maybe more in line with what you're talking about, is to find two people who have different points of view on something. Like keep asking questions until you find the thing they disagree about so that you can have the back and forth and the conflict that honestly is often quite entertaining. Not all the time, but I'm not going to pretend like I don't like to watch it from time to time. I do think that that happens, but I also think that how many people are in a position and able to present in the ways that you're talking and also make it legitimately compelling for the median viewer. That's the hard part. Like, and I would prefer not to toot my own horn about this, but the reason that you're talking to me right now is less because I do this per se than it is that I can do this.
Again, we're talking about what you do, which is the idea of asking questions about an institution or institutions, but also recognizing the fact that we have affection for these institutions that we have questions about.
Yeah.
And what you do, again, there's a playfulness in it, which is the fun of it for me, because you're talking about ideas, but also expressing ideas. Again, as an institution, we can't just say sports. You know, you can watch CNN. The idea to sort of try to entertain competing and contradictory thoughts is not encouraged there. It's something that bringing complexity to a particular subject tends to not be part of the broadcast or the televised media landscape.
If you're going to be on television, the necessary condition is that you be visually good on television, all that stuff, right? The sufficient condition, you'd hope, would be and also be interesting. But that's the sufficient condition. The necessary condition is always going to be being good on television, being good on radio, right? Like being something that people are going to watch. So the overlap of the people who can do that first thing and the second thing just really isn't that big. And if you can't find somebody that can do both, you're going to find somebody that does the first part. And so I get what you're saying. The part that I disagree with is just that I don't know, after 20 something years of doing this, how much of the tenor is truly like encouraged on an executive level as much as they're like, look, man, can you do something that works, right? If it works and they get numbers and you get promoted, boom, they'll roll with so much of it. And the easiest path for most people to that is the content that you happen to describe. But like me, for example, it's interesting. Nobody's ever told me to like dumb it down a little bit or, hey, man, you're doing a little bit too much talking about these systemic issues. The reason is when I do that, they actually understand what I'm talking about. But I will say, if I was out here sloganeering, they'd shut that down.
You are still amused by the idea of saying, why do these things butt heads? And what happens when at that point of impact that we all see but doesn't get remarked upon? To me, that's where you live. And that's what makes what the stuff you do so distinctive.
I think that what I'm doing is actually very simple. I think that's why I may push back on some of that is I actually think that what I do isn't that. Like, it's kind of breaking the things down to parameters. But I once met a woman. Her name was Lim Cremondo. She was a managing editor, I want to say, of ESPN.com many years ago. And I remember we had this talk and she told me that in undergrad, she majored in dance. And so, you know, you're running a website. That's interesting, you know, but it gives her a perspective. And she was explaining like how she transferred what she learned in dance into her world. But she said, you know, I just often feel like I just come in and I say, you know, it'll be a lot easier to read if you turn that light switch. And that's what a lot of this stuff is to me. You know, it's just kind of like, hey, if you just hit that switch right there, boop, look what you'll see right in front of you. Yep. Words. And I think that's what a lot of this actually really does come down to, but we're used to reading in the dark.
My guest is Bomani Jones. He does a number of things. Most recently, we've seen him on HBO on Game Theory with Bomani Jones. Again, thank you for doing this.
No problem, man. You have a good one.
That was Bomani Jones, host of HBO's Game Theory with Bomani Jones. This week, the treat comes from Rutherford Falls co-creator Sierra Della Ornelas. It's a film with a universal impact that has the telling resonance for her as a Native American. Stay tuned. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. For The Treat this week, it's Sierra Teller Ornelas, co-creator of Peacock's comedy Rutherford Falls, on a movie about a family that she relates to her own.
This is Sierra Teller Ornelas, and this is The Treat. I mean, the movie that kind of shaped me, I think, was The Godfather. It was one of the first movies I ever saw that was made about a culture by the people from that culture. And as I kind of grew up, realizing the sort of value of that. There was a new print of The Godfather that came out when I worked at the National Museum of the American Indian. And we programmed The Godfather as a Native film. And we got more like intelligent, cogent questions about Native issues from our like mostly white audience showing The Godfather as a Native film than we did showing actual Native films. And I think that there's something about the culture that's infused in every scene in that movie that really resonates with people.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune. And I raised my daughter in the American fashion. I gave her freedom, but I taught her never to dishonor her family.
My father's side is Mexican-American. My grandfather, Ed Ornelas, he fought in Tarawa and was a real sort of rah-rah America guy. And I grew up weirdly with a lot of patriotism, I think just being from Arizona. And then on my mom's side, it was a very strong matrilineal line of Navajo weavers. So the women were the heavies. We ran the businesses. I controlled a lot of the money. And there was a lot of power dynamics. And so I think like The Godfather is a movie about America. And I think it was like a concept that was different than the sort of version of America that I was raised to believe as a kid on my dad's side. And then there was this real struggle to try to find your own identity, but to also make your family as proud as you could in the Michael character.
Fredo, you're my older brother, and I love you. But don't ever take sides with anyone against the family again. Ever.
I remember like looking up to my grandma, who looked a little bit like Marlon Brando as the Godfather. She would sit in this chair and she wouldn't move, and she had a lot of power in our family. And I remember just desperately wanting to impress these women in my family.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me for counsel or for help. I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. Even though my wife is godmother to your only child.
I grew up going to Indian art markets and selling jewelry and selling Navajo tapestries, and there's really no way to like conceptualize how hard it is to make some of those art pieces. And oftentimes, you know, as a kid, I would just be honest with these questions, and my mom would stop me and sort of train me the proper way to sell this stuff and to explain its value. And it was very much like this omerta of, you know, this is how we do this. This is how we operate. This is how we have to present ourselves, even though this is how we actually are. And that duality, I think, is something that is very hard to process. And so I think when you see it on screen, there's a weird comfort to it.
Santino, come here. What's the matter with you? I think your brain is going soft from all that comedy you're playing with that young girl. Never tell anybody outside the family what you're thinking again. Go on.
You know, oftentimes, if you are a woman in comedy or you're a brown person, there's a level of expectations and sometimes a lack of expectations when you enter those rooms. And I have this sort of quiet hum of this knowledge that my people have been telling stories for centuries, right? And they don't know that, but I know that. And I'm not going to tell them that, but I go in with that information and that power and that strength, and eventually they find out. And to me, that is the Godfather. They think they're some just like Italian immigrant and they don't really care. But by the end of the scene, someone's living and someone's not making it, you know, and it's going to be the Corleones who make it. And I think that there's a little bit of that kind of mechanism that movie means a lot to people. But in telling stories, in that, I don't always lead with like, I know what I'm talking about, you know, but I think I do know what I'm talking about. And it's a quiet knowledge that comes from my family.
That was writer and Rutherford Falls co-creator, Sierra Teller Ornelas. The treatment is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney. The show is mixed by Katie Gilchrist. We had help this week from Nick Lamponi and Laura Kandarajan. You're done with me, but Ann Litt is up next with music to launch your weekend. You know me. I'm Elvis Mitchell. To better days, everyone. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.